Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. In 1937, on the 150th anniversary of the adoption by Congress of the Constitution of the United States, the Christian Science Monitor ran a sensational series on the daily sessions of representatives at the Constitutional Convention from each of the 13 United States of the newly formed nation, which was created by revolution. The stories began in May 1937 to approximate the dates of the convention. The articles were written by Tully Nettleton, an avid constitutionalist and self-described student of government. He spent 7 years researching and writing this series for the Monitor, for which he was a Washington, D.C. stationed reporter. The series centered on a fiction of the Monitor sending one of its staff writers, Tully Nettleton, back to 1787 to fill the vacuum of press coverage at the Philadelphia Convention. There were no reporters there. Using records that only became available long after the Constitution had been adopted, foremost James Madison's famous Notes on the Convention, Tully Nettleton reconstructs this epical story as it might have been told at the time in day-to-day reports readers were informed in an introduction to the series on May 19, 1937, the day 150 years earlier delegates gathered in Philadelphia. The day-to-day reporting of thrilling debates, historic struggles, and epical decisions lays bare the framework upon which decisions vital to American democracy today must be reached, quote, unquote, from the Monitor. The series ran for 4 months, the length of the Constitutional Convention. Someone who will probably remain unknown to history pasted or glued the entire series into a sturdy scrapbook, most likely that same year of 1937. My friend Patricia Metzger found it at a garage sale somewhere and presented it to me as a gift in 1987, which was the bicentennial of the Constitution's adoption, but not its ratification by the states, which took another 3 years, and not the Bill of Rights. They had to wait a while. Today, September 15th, 1787, the delegates voted to approve the Constitution they had contrived and haggled over during a long and very hot summer. For this broadcast on public radio 229 years later, I pick up Tully Nettleton's dispatches 2 days earlier on September 13th, 1787. We the People, by Tully Nettleton. Philadelphia, September 13th, 1787. Having spent 4 long hot months piecing together the new Constitution it will propose for the United States, the Federal Convention now has reached the stage of dotting I's and crossing T's, and with this, the stage also of fretful impatience to be done with such petty details of the business. Part of today was spent in reading the newly printed copy of the document section by section and comparing it with the previous draft. The meticulous James Madison of Virginia, coming to the provision for the President's return of a disapproved act of Congress within 10 days after it shall have been presented to him, moved to make it read after the day on which, so that the day it was presented would not be counted as one of the 10. There were shuffling of feet, grumbles, and mutterings of unnecessary, and noisy calls for the question, and the motion was voted down. On a few points, however, decisions of consequence may yet be made. Such are involved potentially in a supplemental report William Samuel Johnson of Connecticut made today for the Committee of Style, offering resolutions as to the manner of ratification of the Constitution and of instituting the new government. The first of these proposes that the documents be laid before Congress with the opinion that it should be submitted to state conventions under the recommendation of the respective legislatures. Attention has thus been drawn to the letter of transmittal offered yesterday by Dr. Johnson in connection with the main report of his committee. This communication is so much in the finely conciliatory vein characteristic of the chairman as to suggest that Dr. Johnson probably devoted himself to this portion of the work while other members of the committee conned over the wording of the Constitution itself. It reads in part, "It is obviously impractical in the federal government of these states to secure all rights of independent sovereignty to each and safety of all. Individuals entering into society must give up a share of liberty to preserve the rest. It is at all times difficult to draw the line between those rights which must be surrendered and those which may be reserved. And on the present occasion, this difficulty was increased by a difference among the several states as to the situation, extent, habits, and particular interest. In all our deliberations on this subject, we kept steadily in our view that which appears to us the greatest interest of every true American, the consolidation of our Union, in which is involved our prosperity, felicity, safety, perhaps our national existence. This important consideration, seriously and deeply impressed on our minds, led each state in the convention to be less rigid on points of inferior magnitude that might have been otherwise expected, and thus the Constitution, which we now present, is the result of a spirit of amity and of that mutual deference and concession which is the peculiarity of our political situation rendered indispensable." And that was Dr. Johnson. The only addition made to the Constitution by the session today consists of a proviso urged by Colonel George Mason of Virginia that the ban on support taxes shall not prevent a state from imposing customary fees for defraying costs of inspecting and storing produce. New Jersey, New Hampshire, and Delaware delegates were at first against the effect of possibly specious charges under its guise, until Colonel Mason added that such regulations shall be subject to revision by Congress. Philadelphia, September 14, 1787. Fear of popular antagonism against banks or monopolies, as well as against too great centralization of power, dissuaded the convention today from including in the new Constitution authority for Congress to grant charters of incorporation, even to promote building of interstate canals. Dr. Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania moved to insert, quote, "a power to provide for cutting canals where deemed necessary," unquote. Roger Sherman of Connecticut objected, "The expense in such cases will fall on the United States and the benefit accrue to the places where the canals may be cut," he said. But James Wilson of Pennsylvania believed they might be made a source of revenue and emphasized the importance of communications with Western settlements. James Madison suggested expanding the motion into a power, quote, "to grant charters of incorporation where the interests of the United States might require and the legislative provisions of individual states may be incompetent," unquote. On this, Rufus King of Massachusetts warned that it would stir up prejudices and divide states into parties, jeopardizing the ratification. In Philadelphia and New York, he said, the power will be read as referring to the establishment of a bank, which has been a subject of contention in those cities. In other places, it would imply mercantile monopolies. Though not mentioned in the debate on the floor, it is reported that Robert Morris of Pennsylvania, who during the Revolution established the Bank of North America and has since defended it in the Pennsylvania legislature, wished to give Congress specific power to establish a national bank. His close Pennsylvania associate, Governor Morris, persuaded him to give this up, saying it was doubtful whether the pending Constitution could be passed at all by the people, that nothing unessential should be put into the Constitution that might raise up enemies, and that to mention a bank would instantly align the anti-bank party in Pennsylvania against the whole instrument. Even against the part of the motion applying solely to canals, the vote was 8-3, only Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Georgia, states with important Western connections, favoring it, and the rest of the subject was dropped. James Madison also moved, supported by Charles Pinckney of South Carolina and James Wilson of Pennsylvania, to give Congress power, quote, to establish a university in which no preferences or distinctions should be allowed on account of religion. But this also failed. Pennsylvania, Virginia, and the Carolinas voting aye, but the rest no, except Connecticut, which divided. Two clauses were discovered which had been left out by the Committee of Style in transcribing and rearranging the articles, one of them a point of great insistence by the Maryland deputation. This is that no preference should be given by commercial or revenue regulations to the port of one state over those of another. The other provision is that all duties shall be uniform throughout the United States. Both were inserted. An effort to increase the size of the House of Representatives was made by Hugh Williamson of North Carolina, who moved to add one half generally to the apportionments for the first Congress and to allow two members to the smallest states. The division on this was narrow, it failing by 5-6. The convention passed a motion by John Rutledge of South Carolina to strike out the clause for appointment of a national treasurer by Congress, leaving him to be appointed in the same manner as other officers. Charles Pinckney and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts moved to insert a declaration that, quote, the liberty of the press should be inviolably observed, unquote. This, however, was rejected by another 6-5 vote. Roger Sherman of Connecticut considered the statement unnecessary because, quote, the power of Congress does not extend to the press. The motions to provide power to grant charters and to establish a university represent two of the rather rare occasions on which suggestions by James Madison have not been accepted or have not at least exerted a telling influence. This young deputy from the foothill country of Virginia, though so short and frail of build that he could not undertake military service, and once thought it useless to study aught save what would prepare him for the next world, has proved himself the most prodigious worker in the convention. Not only has he had a major part in shaping all the general framework of the new Constitution by his recommendations, drawn from history and from service in Congress, but he is understood to have kept a remarkably full set of notes, a virtual abstract of all debates that have transpired from the first day down to the present. He has missed no more than a fraction of an hour from any day, and he has labored with his quill far into the nights in order that posterity might have a fuller record than the official journal of what is here shrouded in secrecy. In Congress, Mr. Madison consistently advocated a federal revenue from duties on imports, defended free navigation of the Mississippi River, and helped arrange the compromise by which Virginia gave up claims to the Northwest Territory. He is accounted the originator of the 3/5 rule for counting slaves, first used in calculating state contributions of funds now carried over into the Constitution in the apportioning of representation. Philadelphia, September 15, 1787. Convention adopts the Constitution. Unanimously adopted. No, not by a unanimous vote of the members. That would be too much to expect after the closeness of compromises and multiplicity of thorny points involved. But by a unanimous vote of the states represented. The Federal Convention today agreed to the fundamental charter, which it has spent 4 months writing, revising, amending, and perfecting for submission to the American people. The new Constitution is being engrossed, that is, copied on parchment, to be ready for signing at the final session on Monday. One presumably last amendment of some importance was accepted in this last day's work, the effect of which is to make one particular item in the document immune from amendment so long as the Constitution shall last. This item is the equality of suffrage by the states in the Senate. Roger Sherman of Connecticut raised the point when the article providing for the manner of amendment to the Constitution was up to be approved. Though 3/5 of the states are required to ratify an amendment, he feared this number, quote, might be brought to do things fatal to particular states, as abolish them altogether or depriving them of their equality in the Senate, unquote. a proviso having already been inserted to protect the slave trade compromise from change, he wished another to provide that no state shall without its consent be affected in its internal police or deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate, quote unquote. The portion about internal police powers might, of course, have vague and broad effects, and James Madison objected, begin with these special provisos, and every state will insist on them, he said. The Sherman motion was voted down 8-3, but when the Connecticut delegate, seconded by Judge David Brearley of New Jersey, then moved to strike out the provision for amendment altogether, and murmurs of protest began to circulate among the small state delegates, Governor Morris acted to stem the dissension. Though an outstanding critic of the equality in the Senate, he moved to save the portion of the proviso on that point. This was done without record vote. Colonel George Mason criticized the whole plan for amendment of the Constitution as being insufficient for protection of the interests of the people, since in both methods of amendment, action depends on Congress. He darkly predicted that, quote, no amendments of the proper kind ever will be obtained by the people if the government should become oppressive, as I verily believe will be the case. Governor Morris, which is his name, not his position, of Pennsylvania, and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, moved in response to this feeling to require a convention of two-thirds of the states, the convention instead of Congress, to propose amendments for ratification as one of the alternative methods. This was accepted. Colonel Mason also endeavored again to obtain some barrier against the imposition of a Navigation Act and asked that no such act be permitted before 1808 without consent of two-thirds of each branch of Congress. Not only would such acts, passed by a bare majority, enhance freight costs, but they, quote, would enable a few rich merchants in Philadelphia, New York, and Boston to monopolize the staples of the southern states and reduce their value perhaps 50%, he complained. The motion failed, however. The closing hour was occupied with refusing a renewed plea by Virginia Governor Edmund Randolph and George Mason to provide for another general and revisionary convention on the Constitution after the actions of the state conventions should be taken and known. Though this proposal had been seconded the other day by Benjamin Franklin, and this time was reinforced by a statement of objections, which Elbridge Gerry declared determined him to withhold his name from the Constitution, it was answered by a no vote from every state. Colonel Mason declared the government as now composed will end either in monarchy or tyrannical aristocracy. This Constitution, he said, has been formed without the knowledge or idea of the people. A second convention will know more of the sense of the people and be able to provide a system more consonant with it. It is improper to say to the people, take this or nothing. He stated for the first time that he could not sign the document as it stands nor support it in Virginia, though with the prospect of another convention, he said he could sign. Referring also to Governor Randolph's similar announcement, Charles Pinckney answered, these declarations from members so respectable at the close of this important scene give a peculiar solemnity to the present moment, but nothing but confusion and contrariety could spring from the experiment. The states will never agree in their plans, and the deputies to a second convention, coming together under the discordant impressions of their constituents, will never agree. Elbridge Gerry listed among his objections the duration and re-eligibility of the Senate, power of the House of Representatives to conceal its journals, powers of Congress over the places of election, representation of three-fifths of blacks as if free men, possibility of monopolies under the commerce power, and most important, jeopardizing of the rights of citizens by, quote, the general power of the legislature to make what laws they may please to call necessary and proper, unquote, to raise armies without limit, and to establish civil courts without juries. Philadelphia, September 17th, 1787. 39 men of most eminent and influential standing in 12 of the American states today wrote their names on the last four pieces of parchment containing what is intended to be a charter of stronger and more effective government for the United States. The new Constitution is now to be sent to Congress and to the respective states for ratification. One last amendment in the document was made on this closing day of the convention, even after the engrossment, and this represented a mark of special deference to General George Washington of Virginia, who was the chairman of the convention. Breaking the silence which he considered imposed by his position as chairman, the former commander of the American Revolutionary Army expressed his wish that a change proposed by Nathaniel Gorham of Massachusetts to permit a larger number of representatives might be adopted. The new maximum is one for every 30,000 inhabitants instead of one for every 40,000. The smallness of the proportion of representatives has been considered by many members of the convention an insufficient security for the rights and interests of the people. Late as the present moment is for admitting amendments, I think this of so much consequence that it would give much satisfaction to see it adopted, General Washington said. The session was opened with a movingly persuasive plea by Benjamin Franklin, read by his Pennsylvania colleague, James Wilson, for unanimous signing of the document. He said in part, "I confess there are several parts of this Constitution which I do not at present approve, but I am not sure I shall never approve them. For I have experienced many instances of being obliged by better information or fuller consideration to change opinions even on important subjects. The older I grow, the more apt I am to doubt my own judgment and to pay more respect to the judgment of others. In these sentiments, sir, I agree to this Constitution with all its faults, if they are such, because I think a general government necessary for us, and there is no form of government but what may be a blessing to the people if well administered, and believe farther that this likely to be well administered for a course of years, and can only end in despotism, as other forms have done before, when the people shall become so corrupted as to need despotic government, being incapable of any other. I doubt, too, whether any other convention we can obtain may be able to make a better constitution. Thus I consent to this constitution, because I expect no better, and because I am not sure that that is not the best. On the whole, sir, I cannot help suppressing a wish that every member of the convention who may still have objections to it would, with me, on this occasion, doubt a little of his own infallibility, and to make manifest our unanimity, put his name to this instrument." And that was Benjamin Franklin. At his proposal, a form was adopted, devised, it is understood, by Governor Morris, by which a member signing needs attest only that the charter has been accepted by unanimous consent of the states as represented in the convention. William Blount of North Carolina said this made it possible for him to affix his name, but Charles Pinckney thought ambiguity would not gain many converts and averred he would sign the Constitution with a view to supporting it with all his influence. Three members of the convention, however, declared regretfully that they could not bring themselves to sign the document. They are Governor Edmund Randolph of Virginia and Colonel George Mason of Virginia and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts. The handsome, tall, young governor of the largest of the states, acknowledged the step, quote, might be the most awful of his life, unquote, but said it was dictated by his conscience. Him and Mr. Gerry fear that holding out to the people a stark alternative to this plan in toto or nothing, without provision for another general convention, may result in anarchy or civil war. All three men have taken active part in the convention and, regardless of this final decision, have made distinct contributions to the charter. Colonel Mason is said to have been turned against it by changes made within the last 2 weeks, which he believes endangers the states and the liberties of their citizens. Of the 16 members who have attended the convention at some time but were not here for the signing, at least three and possibly others are opposed to the work. These include two gentlemen from upper state New York who left early, Judge Yates and Mr. Lansing, and more conspicuously, Luther Martin of Maryland, who is said to have represented hostile interests from the first. A story is told that Mr. Martin one day said in the presence of some deputies, referring to the system before the convention, "I'll be hanged if ever the people of Maryland agree to it." Whereupon his wealthy and jocund colleague from Maryland, Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer, said, "I advise you to stay in Philadelphia, lest you should be hanged." In more serious vein is the account of a comment made by Benjamin Franklin while the last members were signing the Constitution. It happens that back of the president's chair there was painted a rising sun. The elderly Dr. Franklin observed to a few members near him that painters had found it difficult to distinguish a rising sun from a setting sun. "I have," he said, "often and often in the course of the session, and the vicissitude of my hopes and fears as to its issue, looked at that behind the president without being able to tell whether it was rising or setting. But now, at length, I have the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun." The Constitutional Convention adjourned that day, September 17th, 1787. On September 25th, 1789, Congress transmitted to the 13 state legislatures 12 proposed amendments to the Constitution. Numbers 3 through 12 were adopted by the states, effective December 15th, 1791. James Madison proposed the Bill of Rights. And now, a pitch for and defense of the orphan constitutional amendment, which is among the most basic assumptions of democracy, yet still dismally forlorn in political and legal limbo, and which probably obliges a disclaimer that the following is not by any means my opinion only, even though I wrote it. It is about the Equal Rights Amendment, which reads in full, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." The pretense that half the human race is unequal and subordinate to the other half is a persistent malignancy. It has been chronic through history, especially in periods when muscle and force held sensitivity and intelligence in thrall. Yet the need to be equal and free is the most stubborn human hunger. It has taken centuries for women to emerge from the dominance of their male counterparts. It took almost a century for American women to gain the vote. So it should be no surprise that the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution will not stay dead. The ERA was last defeated on July 2, 1982, the date the nation's forefathers declared themselves free from England's tyranny and promised equality to all men in 1776. The ERA failed even though it had the support of 80% of the electorate because of a handful of men in three state legislatures. Five other states, which had initially approved the ERA, rescinded their votes. Those who regard women as chattel celebrated and pronounced the ERA dead. The ERA has been sent to the grave more than once since Alice Paul wrote the amendment in 1923. On July 14, 1982, the same month as ERA's failure to be ratified on deadline, and the same day celebrated as the beginning of the French Revolution in 1789, 51 U.S. senators and 201 representatives co-sponsored the ERA in both houses of Congress. That attempt also failed. A national referendum would probably make the ERA law within a few months. Instead, when revived again, and it will be, it must once more travel the torturously long trail through the states. 38 states must ratify it, and even the most optimistic believe it will take years. One possibility to encourage the process of making the ERA a part of the Constitution is for women to vote all who oppose it from office and support only candidates who endorse it. In the words of Susan B. Anthony, "There shall never be another season of silence until women have the same rights men have on this green earth." And this has been Michael McCusker. Thanks to all of you out there in the public radio KM Unity, who pledged to keep this pesky little radio station alive and cranky.